This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. The Federal Department of Justice says there are more than 3,000 treatment courts in the U.S. These are special dockets that can focus on specific criminal defendants in adult and juvenile courts, including those who have drug dependency issues. These courts are especially relevant today with opioid addiction a problem nationwide. Now, coming up, we're going to learn about a drug court in Pennsylvania and find out whether Connecticut has a similar program. Now, if you've gone through a drug intervention program here in Connecticut, we want to hear from you, too. I'm going to give out the number, and our conversation again will be later, about drug courts. That number, 860-275-7266. Now, first, we're going to talk about a recent story by nc-hit.org. That's the Connecticut Health and Investigative Team, which highlights disparities faced by state residents with sickle cell disease. Do you or a family member have sickle cell? What kind of medical care have you or they experienced? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at wnpr.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Our guests today are going to be joining us in just a minute. We're actually having some technical difficulty, but Peggy McCarthy is a reporter for the Connecticut Health Investigative Team, also known as CHIT. She's going to join us, as well as Deborah Oliver, a volunteer outreach educator for Sickle Cell Disease Association of America in Southern Connecticut. She lives with sickle cell disease. Both are going to join us in just a few minutes. But again, if you know someone who has sickle cell disease, or if it's a family member, we want to hear from you. That number, 860-275-7266. Right now, I'm going to go to Peggy McCarthy. Are you there, Peggy?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Happy Monday to you, Peggy.
Thank you.
You've done a really excellent story here for CHIT, looking at sickle cell disease, or SCD. What exactly is sickle cell? Many of us have heard about it, but we may not know exactly what it does to the human body.
Yeah, it is a genetic blood disorder, and patients experience excruciating pain, life-threatening complications, and early death. And what happens is that blood cells are sticky and misshapen. And as they attempt to travel through patients' blood vessels, it causes intense pain and blood clots. And related issues include organ damage, breathing problems, and patients are also susceptible to stroke. And almost half of people with sickle cell disease die in their 40s.
Now, why did you decide to focus on sickle cell disease, Peggy?
Excuse me?
Why did you decide to focus on this story on sickle cell?
Well, I was assigned this story by my editor, who realized that there really hadn't been much done in Connecticut about it. And there were a few feature stories about some events, things like that, but nothing really about the disease and what it is and what it does and how it affects people.
Now, federal data from the Centers for Disease Control, they estimate 100,000 Americans are living with sickle cell disease. Do we know how many in Connecticut have this disease?
Well, the estimates are about 2,000. If you add up the number of patients that the four hospitals in Connecticut with programs have, it comes out to about 1,000. And doctors estimate that there are another 1,000 in the state who aren't getting care at these centers. The state started testing at birth in 1990, so there are some numbers about how many children have been born with it since then, but there aren't numbers relating to children who have moved to the state from elsewhere or people who were born before 1990. Then there's no national data registry, so everything is really an estimate.
And this is a disease that affects more African Americans and Hispanics in this country?
That's correct. One in 365 patients are African Americans, and one in 16,300 are Hispanic.
Now, in your story for CHIT, you also talk about how in Connecticut, newborn babies are now tested for sickle cell disease. But that wasn't always the case. Tell us a little bit about that history and what prompted this testing to be more standard for newborns.
Well, I think the state does test at birth for various illnesses, and this was added in 1990, and I don't know the history of how it was added.
And so before 1990, they weren't testing for sickle cell disease.
There was not testing, no. So now what happens is if children at birth test positive, they are sent either to Connecticut Children's Hospital or Yale New Haven Children's Hospital.
This is Where We Live. Today we're focusing in on sickle cell disease. Peggy McCarthy is a reporter for the Connecticut Health Investigative Team, also known as CHIT. You can read their stories at c-hit.org. Now, one of the women that Peggy interviewed in her story is Deborah Oliver. She's a volunteer outreach educator for Sickle Cell Disease Association of America in Southern Connecticut. She also lives with sickle cell disease. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I understand that you're a 41-year-old resident here in Connecticut. When were you diagnosed?
Diagnosed at the age of 4.
Mm. And tell us about when you were 4. What did your parents, your mother, tell you about how you were ill and how that diagnosis came to be?
I had pneumonia, and they were wondering why I had pneumonia. And they had me in the system, the hospital system, as Hispanic. And I'm African American. And they never tested me for certain tests, and they were wondering what was going on. And so I guess one of the doctors said, when my mother found out that I was misrepresented in the hospital system, she corrected that. And so then they said, well, let's test her for sickle cell. And that's how they discovered that I had sickle cell anemia SS.
Mm. Now, when you got that diagnosis as a child, when your parents heard about this diagnosis finally, what was known about the disease at the time? Was this something that when people heard that their children had it, that it was a death sentence?
No, I think it was very little. And my family didn't know much. It's been a learning journey, still is a learning journey. There's not much research on it. It's getting better each day, and hopefully this will jumpstart it even a little bit more. However, they just were concerned. They prayed about it. They didn't worry about it. And I kind of had a regular childhood up until the age of about 18. 18, 19, I needed a gallbladder surgery because my gallbladder was inflamed, and it was causing me to have sickle cell crisis at least once a month. And that's kind of when it really started really affecting my life.
Mm. So tell us a little bit more about this chronic pain that you experience. And you mentioned sickle cell crisis. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay, so when I have pain, the best way that I describe it is having like a Charlie horse. And so everybody has experienced a Charlie horse, especially in the wee hours of the morning. And when I'm in pain and the red blood cells are not traveling in my body as they should be because they're in a sickle shape and they get clustered together in a certain area and can't move, and the flow of oxygen isn't all that great, and possibly my blood levels are low, I get this pain that's really sharp, and it's like 100, maybe 1,000 worse than what a regular pain would be. And so a regular Charlie horse pain would be. And so it feels like a Charlie horse. It feels like something that you can't get rid of. You're walking around, you're rubbing the area that it's affected in, and it that's how I describe my pain. There are lots of other sickle cell patients who experience pain on a different level. Mm-hmm. We're not all the same. I think lots of times we all get grouped the same, that we all have the same pain, but that's not the case. Some people have pain worse than others. But I've heard that, the Charlie horse story. I've heard some people saying it feels like they're getting stabbed in the leg or wherever their pain is associated over and over again, and they need relief.
Mm. Peggy McCarthy is, again, a reporter for the Connecticut Health Investigative Team. In your story, you write about Deborah's experience, but you also focus in on children with sickle cell, including a little boy, a 9-year-old named Jeremy Brown. Tell us a little bit how the pain varies from patient to patient and what a child like Jeremy experiences.
Well, Jeremy had been very, very ill, and he was in the hospital
at least once a month from the time he was 6 months old to 6 years, and he had excruciating pain episodes. And his father did ask a doctor, what is he feeling? The father was holding his son, and the doctor said, it is like he is being stabbed all over his body. So he started one of the only two medications that have been approved for sickle cell disease. And he started 2 years ago with hydroxyurea, and it has been working for him. And he has not had a hospitalization since. So the last time I spoke with his mother, she said he was still doing well. So the hope is that that will continue to work for him. It helps to deter or relieve these horrendous pain episodes. He is having issues with growth, which is another side effect, and he does have to go to see a doctor about the growth issues. There are other complications that come with this, but this year he has been able to go to school without many absences, and which has been helpful for his parents too. His father once lost a job because he had to be with Jeremy when he was hospitalized. So it affects the whole family as well.
In your story, and you just mentioned one of these medications, but there are only two medications to help treat sickle cell disease, Peggy?
That's correct. Sickle cell disease was first identified in 1910, and it took until 1998 for the first one, hydroxyurea, to be approved by the FDA, and for somebody to research a medicine that could be used specifically for sickle cell disease. And the second was only approved last year in 2017, called Endari. So that isn't even in widespread use yet. This compares with, I saw an NPR report actually about hemophilia, and that has 28 approved drugs with another 21 in development. And that affects mostly white males in about 200,000 people in the country. So there hasn't been much attention given to sickle cell disease in terms of research and pharmaceutical money for research. And so the patients have really been hurting physically, because the only thing that, you know, the main thing that helps them are opioids. Mm.
Deborah Oliver, we're hearing again about just two medications to treat sickle cell. You were talking about how you deal with chronic pain on a daily basis. What are your options to manage your pain?
Well, I'm not a candidate for the hydroxyurea. I have discussed it with my private hematologist, and I'm not off sick as often. I am sick once, as far as being hospitalized, once or twice a year. For the most part, I manage my care with staying with a great dietary plan that my doctor and I have come up with, as well as my internal medicine. I kind of work as a team with them, and I think that's important to work with the medical staff as a team and not just the medical staff just knowing everything and finding out what works best for you. When I am sick, they hospitalize me and they give me the oxygen, and if I need a blood transfusion, and they also prescribe, give me narcotics when I'm in a hospital if needed. And sometimes it is needed, and sometimes if I'm in a hospital, it's definitely needed. But on a daily basis, I don't take anything other than the daily prescription of folic acid, and I try to stay hydrated. I know what works best for me and what doesn't. I know what triggers my sickle cell crisis, and I try to stay away from that, avoid those kind of situations. And I just try to live each day like it's the rest of my life, or, you know, like treasure each day that I have.
Deborah Oliver is a Connecticut resident living with sickle cell. Peggy McCarthy is also with us, reporter for the Connecticut Health Investigative Team at CHIT.org. We're focusing on sickle cell disease after Peggy reported a recent story about the disparities that exist among people who have sickle cell disease. Are you one of them? We want to hear from you this hour, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Coming up, we're going to talk with a medical doctor to learn more about the disease, and we'll take your calls too. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about sickle cell disease, a disease that predominantly affects African Americans and Hispanics in the U.S. My guests are Peggy McCarthy, a reporter for CHIT, who recently wrote a piece about the disparities that exist for sickle cell patients. Deborah Oliver is also with us. She lives with sickle cell disease, and she's a volunteer outreach educator for Sickle Cell Disease Association of America, Southern Connecticut. And now joining our conversation is Dr. John Roberts, medical director of Yale New Haven's Adult Sickle Cell Program. Dr. Roberts, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So we were learning a little bit about sickle cell disease earlier. Tell us about the programs, the treatment programs that exist in the state.
So there are three programs in the state for adults and two for children. For children, there's a program at Children's Medical Center of Connecticut, and there's a program at Yale New Haven Hospital in New Haven. And for adults, there is a program at the University of Connecticut in Farmington and at Yale New Haven Hospital in New Haven. And there's also a program at Bridgeport Hospital.
We were talking earlier that many of us don't know much about sickle cell disease unless we may have it or we know someone who does. When you look throughout your medical career, how would you describe what trends you've seen on raising awareness about sickle cell or even how providers treat the disease?
I think that there's been an increasing awareness of the disease since breakthroughs in the treatment of children with sickle cell disease in the 1980s led to many more people affected with the disease surviving into adulthood. Before that, many children unfortunately died of infections, but by treating children now, making sure that they have vaccinations for pneumococcal pneumonia, and children under the age of 5 take daily penicillin to prevent pneumococcal infections. So it had a dramatic change on infections in children and allowed children to live to adulthood. And so it became a condition that adult clinicians became more familiar with. In terms of changes in management, the important change was the advent of hydroxyurea in the late 1990s, which has led to a dramatic change for many patients, and also has allowed people to live longer. As was mentioned, we have a new drug that was available in December. It's still too early to tell what impact that drug will have. And then I think that in general, there's more willingness to use opioids appropriately to treat patients with sickle cell disease who are in pain now than there was in the 1880s, or I mean 1980s. It was the late 1980s that patient advocates started pointing out that because doctors were worried about opioid abuse and opioid addiction, they were very reluctant to treat patients with opioids. And the big push there was in the cancer community, but that led to more willingness to use opioids in other patient populations. And of course, as is often the case now, we're struggling with probably the pendulum swung too far, and so we need to carefully rein in the use of opioids in medicine. But at the same time, we don't want to prevent people with needs for opioids, like people living with sickle cell disease or people living with cancer. We want them to still be able to get them. So that's a dilemma.
Deborah Oliver, what has been your experience when you have sought opioids to deal with your pain in the past?
I have different experiences. It depends on where I'm at and who's treating me. For the most part, because of my private insurance, I'm seen at the Yale Health Plan, and they know me. They have a relationship with me. There's definitely a trust. If I am transferred somewhere else into another hospital and I don't know the doctors, there is some kind of discrimination or lack of trust both on my side and their side. And it's been difficult to get relief when there's a lack of trust in a relationship. And so I always encourage patients, and I encourage the medical staff. Somebody has to let their guard down. Mm. We have a person who is in pain. I'm in pain. My goal is to not be in pain. And we have to come to some kind of compromise where I can trust you and you can trust me, and you're not just looking at me on the outward appearance, and you're not believing that I'm in pain, or that you're too scared to give me the necessary requirement dose for me to be relieved for the pain. Unfortunately, lots of times, we as sickle cell patients face that. We face the fact that we're not believed, or we are just coming to seek narcotics, which is kind of ridiculous, because if that was the case, then we're coming in a controlled environment to get a controlled substance when we can go out in the street, and we have seen that, and that's not the case. We are trying to put our trust and hoping that the person is taking their oath seriously and really taking care of us and not discriminating against what we look like or what they perceive for us to be.
Dr. John Roberts, again, medical director of Yale New Haven's Adult Sickle Cell Program. Can you respond a little bit to what Deborah was sharing with us? And you had referenced this earlier about because of the nation's problems with opioid overprescription and addiction, there has to be, some kind of there's like a reckoning almost in like how we go about getting care for pain, but at the same time making sure that it's being prescribed in the right way, and where people who are in chronic pain, they're able to get the pain relief that they're looking for without feeling that they really have to justify to the provider that this is not something they're just getting because they may be addicted.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the keys is what Ms. Oliver referred to, which is that she gets high-quality care at the Yale Health System because they know her. And so there's a history there. There's documentation in the medical record of her illness and her response to illness and her response to opioids and how other people have managed her problem. And so when she goes there, even if she's seeing a provider, a clinician who she's not met previously, the medical record creates a history that allows both Ms. Oliver and the provider to have confidence that they know what they're up to. There are, unfortunately, some individuals with sickle cell disease who are in Connecticut emergency departments all over the state on a regular basis. I was called once about a patient of mine who'd literally been in the emergency department more than once a day for the last 8 months. I was seeing the patient on a regular basis, but she wasn't sharing with me that she was addicted to opioids and that she was pursuing opioids on a daily basis. Now, the number of individuals who are doing this is an extremely small number of small fraction of the people living in the state with sickle cell disease. However, they are so persistent in their pursuit of drugs that they can color the perspective of a clinician who works in an emergency department. And so it's a very difficult situation for both the patient and the provider and the clinician when a patient, a person with sickle cell disease who is in pain and who is seeking relief in a bona fide way, it's a very difficult position when they're in an unfamiliar emergency department with a clinician who's not familiar with the person and doesn't have access to medical records that give them reliable information about that person. If we had if one's a veteran, now there aren't many veterans who have sickle cell disease because they're not likely to get into the into the uniformed services, but they're family members of veterans who are covered. Nevertheless, if one's a veteran, one wherever one goes in the United States, the medical record is available. And so clinicians seeing a veteran for the first time can learn whether past clinicians have what their assessment was of the veteran's situation. And if, for example, a veteran has a chronic pain problem that requires higher doses of medications on occasion, the clinician can see that in the medical record. We don't have that for civilians in the United States. And so clinicians who are working in emergency departments can be in a difficult situation. That's a tragedy for the patients, because then when the patients are legitimately seeking care, including pain relief, sometimes they can't access what they should be able to get.
Dr. John Roberts is medical director of Yale New Haven's Adult Sickle Cell Program. This is where we live. Today we're focusing in on sickle cell disease. 100,000 Americans are estimated to have this disease, about 2,000 here in Connecticut. Also with us is Peggy McCarthy, reporter for the Connecticut Health Investigative Team. Now, Peggy, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation because in your story you talk about the ER care that many sickle cell patients are getting. Advocates say it's poor ER care that's caused deaths due to a lack of knowledge about sickle cell disease. I understand in your reporting you also found there were programs that were created to help ERs around the state deal with sickle cell patients. Tell me a little bit about that, and if that kind of plan has been adopted by ER departments so that there's better care for sickle cell patients.
Well, two doctors affiliated with two of the programs, Dr. Barry Andemariam from UConn and Dr. William Zemsky from Connecticut Children's, came up with a protocol for emergency rooms to use for sickle cell patients, but none of the Connecticut emergency rooms have adopted it. And this, I'm talking about the hospitals that do not have programs for sickle cell disease. So it's everything except Yale, Bridgeport, Connecticut Children's, and UConn. So people go in and they, as Dr. Roberts said, the majority are looking for relief from their excruciating pain, and opioids provide that relief. But as an advocate from the Hartford Organization for Sickle Cell Disease, Citizens for Quality Sickle Cell Care, Virginia Pertelar said people are accused of going to emergency rooms to get high, not to relieve pain. And they're mistreated, maltreated, and they're enduring harmful long waits. The National Institutes of Health in 2014 came up with a protocol that sickle cell patients should be given medication within an hour of arriving at the emergency room, and there are reports that that does not occur. So it really, you know, there are people who say that deaths have happened because of poor care and inadequate care, and a lot of doctors are totally unfamiliar with sickle cell disease. Medical schools don't spend much time on it at all, and I did see a study that said that many doctors are frankly uncomfortable in treating sickle cell disease because they're just unfamiliar with it.
Dr. Roberts, can you respond to what Peggy was telling us?
It's a complicated issue. Most visits are around the issue of pain, and therefore most visits, unless, as we discussed earlier, the patient is in a health facility that knows the patient well and has well documented in the medical record what the patient's issues are, whenever any kind of patient is an unfamiliar patient is in an emergency department with pain, there's always issues about appropriate or inappropriate use of opioids. Pain, obviously, we want to treat effectively, and often it requires high dose of opioids for people with sickle cell disease. And, for example, at Yale New Haven Hospital, for the patients we know, we have individualized care plans that give the emergency room doctors advice about how to deal with pain. And sometimes these care plans recommend that they start with a very high dose of opioids, because our experience is that lower dose of opioids will not be effective. But, of course, if one of our patients is visiting a relative in another part of the state, and that emergency room physician doesn't have access to our medical record, then they're in a difficult situation. It's rare that patients present with life-threatening problems, but when they do need to be addressed very quickly, or there is a risk of death. It's not pain per se that causes death in sickle cell disease. It's typically lung problems or heart problems. It's by the nature of the disease, it's an uncommon disease. The average emergency department physician is not going to be familiar with patients with that problem. So the job of ED physicians is to be familiar with all sorts of things, including uncommon things. And one would hope that patients would always get excellent care. But I don't know. I don't have data about what happens in emergency departments other than UConn and Yale New Haven Hospital to really help with that.
Do a lot of people in our state go untreated, Dr. Roberts, because there are only four facilities that specialize in treating sickle cell disease? And how do we improve the access to that?
Yeah, so that's a good concern. I think many adults go without treatment. Partly that's sort of a normal transition when children with chronic illnesses become adults. From the medical perspective, these are people that have a chronic condition and they should, you know, be appropriate and see doctors on a regular basis. But as young adults transition from their pediatricians to their internists, they often just sort of disappear because they don't want to think every morning when they wake up. You know, they're struggling with self-identity, establishing themselves in the world, establishing career path, establishing personal relationships. They don't want to think of themselves as a person with a chronic illness that could shorten their life or lead to disability. And so across a number of diseases, it's common for children to disappear, to fail to make the transition from pediatric to adult care. However, that's complicated in a major way in sickle cell disease, because it is a disease of people of African ancestry in the United States. And as we know, African Americans have been discriminated against for centuries in this country and continue to be discriminated against. And so as individuals and as families, they have less wealth and less income than mainstream Americans. Over half the adults with sickle cell disease in Connecticut probably are on Medicaid as their only health insurance, and providers are less than enthusiastic about taking care of patients with Medicaid because, among other things, it covers less than the cost of caring for the patients. So one has to have a sense of mission in order to deal with it, to take care of people who are on Medicaid. So there are many communities in Connecticut where there are people living with sickle cell disease, but there are not providers who are really focused and committed to taking care of people who have serious problems related to sickle cell disease. And so both patients don't present as frequently as they should, and also the medical, you know, you see billboards on 95, if you have heart attack or stroke, come to our center. You don't see any billboards about sickle cell disease, and that's not a mistake. The medical system, for a variety of reasons, is not really welcoming to people with this problem.
This is Where We Live. Today we're focusing in on sickle cell disease. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Reggie's calling from Greenwich. Reggie, go ahead.
Yes, hi, thank you. The doctor actually, thanks for taking my call. The doctor actually began to touch on this issue of income and income disparities and lack of investment in African Americans in terms of healthcare. It is a fact that a bone marrow transplant has a 90% cure rate for sickle cell. I have a niece who went through the bone marrow transplant. Her parents were comfortable enough to be able to pay for it, and she is now cured of sickle cell. I'm surprised that this is not even being discussed in this program, and I'm sure it's the price tag of the $200,000 to $300,000. But couldn't we raise that and at least save one person and then begin to save others instead of all of these other things that we're talking about here? And I'll take my answer offline.
So Reggie's talking about the cost of this treatment, but I'm curious, Dr. Roberts, in terms of these kinds of bone marrow transplants, how successful are they, and when can someone with sickle cell disease actually get this treatment?
Yeah, so I'm very glad that Reggie brought this up. I agree with him. It's an omission that we didn't discuss it earlier. It is a potentially curative therapy for sickle cell disease. The first problem is that, and it is an expensive therapy, but it will be covered by Medicaid in Connecticut. And so I don't think the finances are the barrier to people getting this treatment, at least for Medicaid patients. Now, for the working poor who don't have Medicaid, yes, it would be a tremendous barrier. The other issue with bone marrow transplant is that the results are very good when one has a perfect match. But a perfect match would be a full brother or sister, and it would be, and because of genetics, only one out of four full brothers or sisters is going to turn out to be a perfect match. So in the United States, for every person with sickle cell disease, only about one out of five of those people has a perfect match available, a fully matched brother or sister to do a bone marrow transplant. So those people certainly should consider this option, but for the four out of five people who do not have a perfect match, bone marrow transplants can be available, but they're still a research intervention, and the reason for that is that there's still, unfortunately, deaths related to doing bone marrow transplants in people who are not a perfect match. Now, the death rate should be zero in people who are a perfect match in an ideal world. It should be a safe procedure. But as Reggie said, there's a 90% cure rate. If one is treating, so most commonly we treat cancers with bone marrow transplant, like leukemias, and those are likely to lead to death in a matter of weeks or months in people who otherwise undergo a transplant. For sickle cell disease, it's a very difficult decision for patients and their parents, because the best time to transplant people is when they're young, like 10 years or younger. But sickle cell disease is not immediately fatal, and so a 10-year-old has a prospect of living to their 40s or early 50s in the United States. If the death rate really is 10%, and I think it's actually much less than that for people with a perfect match, I think it's like that for people without a perfect match. If the death rate is, say it's a 5% death rate, it's scary to think about a 1 in 20 chance of dying now of a medical procedure so that one will be able to live into 160s, 70s, or 80s. That's an unusual trade-off for people to face. And so people have a hard time making that choice.
Before we have to end the segment, I wanted to go back to Deborah Oliver, who was living with sickle cell disease. You know, we focused a lot of the conversation on the lack of medications to treat sickle cell disease and the fact that many patients have to rely on opioids because of the chronic pain. But what about medical marijuana, Deborah? Is that something that that has gotten enough awareness, and is that something that that should be more attention should be raised and to help patients with the pain?
Well, I think that it has been awareness among the sickle cell community as far as the patients who I communicate with on social media, or the individuals that I communicate on social media. As far as the medical staff, a lot of them are not as keen to prescribe that. There's a trust issue, and it's hard to trust me when I don't look like you and when you think I'm less than you. And so if you are not taking your oath seriously and you're not doing it for the love of trying to treat people, then of course you're going to give that person a hard time. And that happens all the time, whatever the case may be in dealing with our pain, whether it's opiate or marijuana. And I feel like if marijuana works for that individual and they discuss it with their doctor, I think that it's an option that they should try. I think that anything that a patient feels like they are comfortable in trying, then the doctor should be upfront and honest about what the risks are and discuss it, and then say to them, okay, let's try it. Let's be comfortable with it and not push things onto them that they're not comfortable with, other medications or such as hydroxyurea. I think that it should be a team effort, and lots of times it's not a team effort. And when you are in a situation where you're being treated by somebody who doesn't know you, I think that, again, you have to take your oath seriously, and you treat that person like they're a loved one or how you would want to be treated. And it's lack of education on the medical arena end of it, and I think they need sensitivity treatment just like the people from Starbucks. If you're going to get trained, you need to be trained. You need to know what sickle cell is. There are lots of times where I hear stories of sickle cell friends who say that I have doctors and nurses coming into my room and asking me how long have I had sickle cell, which is absolutely ridiculous, because if everybody has access to Google, why don't you Google it if you're not too sure what sickle cell is or what my diagnosis is? It only takes a few minutes out to look up something on the internet and know that it's hereditary and that you're born with it, and not come in with a question that's ridiculous to say, how long have you had it? So I think a lack of training is definitely necessary. So again, with your question about opiates, I'm definitely for it. If it works for the person, then why not? Why not that be on the list of what we can do to help you ease your pain so that you are not on any drugs, whether it's hydroxyurea or an opiate.
Deborah, we're going to have to leave it there. Deborah Oliver, thank you for joining us today. Also, Peggy McCarthy, reporter for the Connecticut Health Investigative Team, and Dr. John Roberts, medical director of Yale New Haven's Adult Sickle Cell Program. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we know opioid addiction is a problem nationwide. Some states have added drug courts to help criminal defendants with substance abuse issues. Incarceration isn't the only answer. We're going to learn more about this treatment option for people, again, in Connecticut and nationwide, right after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. The Federal Department of Justice says there are more than 3,000 treatment courts nationwide. We wanted to know more about what that means exactly, and we heard about an interesting programs in Pennsylvania counties. Joining us on the phone is Rich Lord, who's a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lucy. Great to be here.
I understand that you profiled some of these so-called drug courts. What does that mean exactly, and how do they offer up alternatives to incarceration?
What's different about drug courts is that they're not adversarial like your typical criminal proceeding. There's a team approach in which all of the parties, including the prosecutor and the defense attorney, are really supposed to be working toward the recovery of the defendant. And typically the defendant starts out on some form of either pretrial release or some form of probation. They go before the judge, though, every week at the beginning. And in between appearances with the judge, they receive multiple drug tests and they go to recovery treatment and meetings. A team of probation officers and social workers tries to help them to, first of all, stay off drugs and in treatment, get decent housing, you know, find a job, deal with family problems that have built up, all that stuff. And usually you move up through different phases. And as you move up, as you get these various parts of your life together, your supervision loosens up a little bit. You don't have to come to court as often. And if you mess up, you dephase, as they call it, or move down a step, meaning that things kind of tighten up for you a bit. If you keep messing up to the point where it's clear that you're not really interested in recovery, but maybe you're just trying to avoid prison, then they steer you back into the regular court system and you might get jail or prison.
Now, when we're talking about options to get people support, again, these are nonviolent criminal defendants in many of these programs. How do they go about finding the community providers? Are they providers that advocate abstinence, or is there medication-assisted treatment? Is that something that's growing in terms of being receptive to that might, like Suboxone, that might help people?
That's definitely the great divide in the drug courts right now. There are roughly 1,500 pure drug courts and another roughly 2,000 either veterans courts or juvenile drug courts or kind of family or drunk driving courts in the country. And they're split roughly half between the abstinence-only camp and kind of the medication-assisted treatment camp, with probably a little more than half in the medication-assisted treatment camp right now. And kind of like society as a whole, they're trying to figure out what to do with this problem. Some of the drug courts think that the kind of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous model where, you know, you achieve a state of being, quote, clean or substance-free is the way to go. But others are saying, hey, if methadone or buprenorphine, that's the ingredient in Suboxone, if those work for you, then, you know, we'll work with that. So just like you're seeing in the whole recovery community, a big debate about that, you're seeing that unfold in drug courts, even in my region and definitely nationally.
Rich Lord is reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette as we learn about more and more treatment courts becoming an option for nonviolent criminal defendants nationwide. We were curious what was going on here in Connecticut. Joining us now is Judge Robert Devlin, Jr., presiding criminal judge for the Fairfield Judicial District. Judge Devlin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
We just have a couple of minutes, but we're curious if Connecticut has technically these drug courts and what programs do you offer nonviolent defendants?
Connecticut had drug courts, but we've sort of pivoted to a different model. We're trying to reach as many people as we can to help them with their addiction problems. So we have drug intervention courts where we sort of collect drug cases on one docket, and they are we try to route people to services through that. We have a very interesting pilot program, our treatment pathways program here in Bridgeport, that on the day the person is arrested, we see if they might qualify for treatment, if they're interested in getting treatment. And we have piloted that now for about 2 years. We've had about 300 people go through the program. And with some real prospects, some real good success, we're trying to expand that now in July to other New London and Waterbury and Torrington. So, we see the drug court as one model, but we're trying to reach more people more efficiently, and we think we were able to do that with these other programs.
There have been issues with money being taken away from the judicial branch over the years, This is an alternative, Judge Devlin, to help people with substance abuse issues if you can't have just one drug court allocated to do this for these people?
Yeah, I mean, you take a drug court might have 30 or 40 people in the drug court. There might be, 1,500 active cases pending in that court. Now, many of them are not suitable for drug court, but the idea is, to focus all your resources on a very narrow set of people tends to diminish what you can do for others. So we're trying to do the most we can for the most people.
And we were hearing from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Rich Lord about depending on the type of treatment court and the state, not all programs embrace medication-assisted treatment versus abstinence. What's Connecticut's take on that?
Well, I can speak about our treatment pathways program because we've actually looked at that carefully. And of the people that have successfully completed the program, those that took the medicine did better. I mean, you compare the people that just went through an abstinence program versus those that went through a medically assisted program, the success rate was 60% greater for people who were on methadone or Suboxone or one of these other medicines that are used. I realize there's criticism of that, but, quite frankly, Connecticut is, we're trying to fight this opioid crisis. I mean, we're 12th in the nation in terms of per capita deaths from opioid overdose. So if this medicine works, personally, I'm all for it.
We'll have to leave it there, but it shows that from what Judge Devlin was telling us, that the evidence shows that it is working, these treatment courts, and there are programs here in Connecticut that offer that alternative to criminal defendants. We want to thank Judge Robert Devlin, Jr. again. Also, Rich Lord, who is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, will tweet out some links at Where We Live to learn more about different treatment courts around the country. Today's show produced by senior producer Lydia Brown. Special thanks to Kion Wolf and Carmen Baskoff. Also, Gina Matruda. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.